My name is Andrew Schwartz, and I'm the Vice President for External Relations here at CSIS. And I have the honor of standing in for my boss, John Hamry, our CEO, who would have loved to have been here for this excellent gathering, honoring Bob Schieffer, who's our man, who's everybody's man. And we're so fortunate to be partnered with the Texas Christian University, TCU, Schieffer School of Journalism, also known as the Horned Frogs, for all you Horned Frogs out there. But we are so thrilled to have this Schieffer series in journalism. And what we thought we'd do tonight is something a little bit different. In the past, we've had foreign policy and national security forums. Tonight, we're going to, in honor of Bob's new book, Bob Schieffer's America, which, by the way, is on sale in the back there, hoping that, you know, you'll buy three, not just one, but three copies. We're going to turn the tables. We have two extremely distinguished people here. We have Leonard Downey, who has been with the Washington Post since he was an intern in 1964, and I think pretty much had every single job at the Washington Post. And he was, of course, the executive editor since 1991. He's now vice president at large, and we're absolutely thrilled to have Leonard Downey here. David Sanger is another matter. David Sanger is sort of, you know the old joke about Mike Wallace? Mike Wallace is on the other line. You don't want to talk to Mike Wallace. I think there's a lot of people in town who feel that way about David, respectfully. Because when David calls, you know that he's going to ask you some hard questions, and we hope that he has some hard questions for Bob tonight. But again, we are thrilled to have three, not just two, but three journalists, including our favorite journalist, Bob Schieffer, here tonight. And with that, I will give it to David Sanger, who will start this festive occasion.
Well, thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here, and it's wonderful to be here with Bob, but it's particularly wonderful to be here to ask Bob questions, because as you probably know, at the end of Bob's program, when he does these wonderful essays, he has his brief opportunity to either reveal something about America or reveal something about himself. And I was kind of curious, Bob, just to get this started, you know, it's only a 30-minute show, so Bob's favorite line is, let's get right to the point, which is a way of saying, the other guys have 30 more minutes than I do. Don't waste my damn airtime, right? So let's get right to the point, Bob. A few weeks ago, just before the convention in Denver, you gave one of these essays. It was too late to make it into this book. And you had a significant revelation in this one. You revealed that your daughter was born 9 months, almost to the day, after the Chicago convention. So my first question to you, Bob, is do you owe CBS a little back pay?
I tell you, what I owe is getting back in good with my wife. I had actually written about that in my first book, This Just In, and she's sitting over there at the side. We're doing this on the convention floor. And when I said that, she went, oh! I said, well, yeah, that's an old story, everybody. She said, but my God, did you have to do it on national television? It is absolutely a true story. And there's more to this story. We didn't... Yeah, I better explain.
I think there is.
We would hope so.
We would like to hear it, yeah. Is there video?
No. But we had thought we were not going to have children. And the last thing we did, this was our first trip out of town since our honeymoon. We'd been married a couple of years. We thought we weren't going to have kids. My wife had actually gone to the Edna Gladney home in Fort Worth to set up the first appointment so we could start the process to adopt a child. Exactly 9 months to the day after that convention, little Susan Schieffer was born, and I guess Susan was in high school when she kind of finally put the numbers together. And one day she said to her mom, well, I guess it wasn't all fighting in the streets out there in Chicago. But there's even more to the story. As you all know, the Democrats did not go back to Chicago until when? 1996. When they returned to the Bill Clinton convention out there. At that convention, that same daughter, Susan Schieffer, ran into a guy that she had gone to graduate school with at the University of Texas, and they, as a result of that, got together, and they married, and that's the person she married. So Chicago political conventions, they're a big deal at our house, and we all have fond memories of that. So, but it's absolutely true. I'm glad you gave me a chance to explain.
Once again, we've got presidential candidates running against Washington. You know, it's a terrible place. They're going to come and shake it up and change it. As you go through these essays, as well as other things that you've written, you clearly have a fondness for this town and for the politicians in it. What do you see differently from what is being portrayed by these candidates?
Well, I love it. I mean, Washington has been my life, and I always say, you know, I'm like a cowboy around horses. I mean, cowboys just like to be around horses. They don't have to be good horses, and I'm kind of that. I'm kind of that way about politicians. I mean, I just like to be around them. I like to study them. Sometimes I get disgusted with them. But I'll tell you, Lynn, when you sit up in that press gallery on one of those nights when the president makes the State of the Union speech, which is my favorite night in Washington. I know it's an acquired taste, like swimming in the ocean, but be that as it may, it's my favorite night. You look out on the floor of the Congress. I think it's like the National Zoo. And what I mean by that, there is one example of every kind of person we have in America. There are tall ones and short ones and black ones and white ones and dumb ones and smart ones. There's one example of every kind of person that makes up America, and you realize what a diverse country this is. And it, to me, I just never got over it. It's the thrill of looking out there and seeing that group of people out there. And it's been my life, and I've loved every minute of it.
Well, Bob, let's follow up and talk about that group of people. One of my favorite essays you've got here is Barry Bonds is No Hero. There are only two groups of people there are two groups and one object described in this book, okay? There are politicians, there are baseball players, and there are cell phones. Bob went through a sort of cell phone obsessive period around 2000.
I did.
Yeah, and there are several essays on cell phones. But let me turn to baseball for a moment. You wrote about Barry Bonds with a candor that I'm not sure I've necessarily heard you offer about some politicians. Here's what you said. Bonds is booed every place he plays except his home park in San Francisco. First, because he is widely believed to be a cheat who used illegal drugs to increase his strength. Second, because he is a self-centered, all-around jerk who sees no responsibility to the fans who pay his enormous salary.
Well, I often try to use the needle rather than the...
Yeah. So I thought since you raised in this essay so well the idea of self-centered, all-around jerks, and you've been covering Washington for 40 years, there had to be some intersection. And so we'll give you a pass. You don't need to talk about self-centered jerks who are still alive, but if you want to, that would be fine. But tell us about some of your worst experiences interviewing people here.
The hardest person to interview, and I'll tell you about that in a second. Let me just say something about Barry Bonds, because this is something that I thought a long time about this. I have always wanted to be two things. I wanted to be, number one, I wanted to be a baseball player. And I played through high school, and then I got to college, and my arm finally gave out. And, you know, if somebody had told me that if you'll just rub this magic potion on your arm and it'll be well and you may get to actually get a chance to be a professional ball player, I would have done it. I would have done it no matter what doctor said, no matter how dangerous they said it was. I would have done it because I would have known that my heroes had done it, the ball players up there. And these were my heroes. I think these
people... You've got a great line in here about what your father said to you after your best performing game.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll get that. He said, well, Bobby, you might make a ball player one day. But, you know, these people had such an obligation to set a good example for young people, because people hang on their every word. And then when you see what they did to the game and the example they set, I just couldn't stand it. I mean, because I know how much it meant to kids out there. And that's what I held against Barry Bonds. Barry Bonds was no hero. He was a guy who hit home runs, and it just kind of started and stopped with me there, and that's why I took the line that I took. I have run across some people in Washington that I didn't like very much, but, you know, they really are the exception. Most of the people who come to Washington are good people who have good intentions, and many of them are very, very, very smart people. We do have the occasional thug. We do have the occasional crook, but I guess the percentage that got to Washington, it's probably no larger than it is in any other a country we know, and we all know who they are. But for the most part, I've liked the people that I've covered, and I like to be around them. I think they're good people who are trying to make this a better country.
For a long time, sports writers didn't write about that sort of thing, the picadillos of athletes. Mm-hmm. And your reporting career about politics goes back to the time when often things weren't written about politicians that reporters knew that probably the public should have known. Are there things that you regret now that you didn't report at the time?
Things were beginning to change when I came to Washington, and I think one of the reasons that a lot of things that were off limits at one time was because we used to have an all-male press corps. And I think when women came on the scene, I think because the guys have to kind of clean up their act. And we have so many women in journalism now that I think it's a very good thing, quite frankly. And I think we have to get the complete picture. I think a lot of things that men were willing to overlook, women had a different view on it. And I think that's one of the reasons that things did change. I think for the most part it's probably been a good thing. Now, we need to get the story on people. We need to know who people are, and especially when it impacts on the job they do. I mean, I don't care when they go home and what they do when mm-hmm. nobody else is mm-hmm. around, but these are positions of trust, and when they're going to violate that trust, I think it's perfectly fair, and I think it's our responsibility to report that.
And as you look back, was there something that you wish you had reported at the time that that you didn't?
Well, I tell you, one of the lessons I learned, and I won't go into detail because mm-hmm. I think most people know this, but, you know, after John Kennedy was shot, and I was working at the Star-Telegram, and I'm trying to help out answering the phones on the city desk, I get a call, and a woman said, "Is there anybody there who can give me a ride to Dallas?" And I said, "Lady, you know, the president's just been shot, and besides, we're not running a taxi service." And she said, "Yeah, I heard it on the radio. I think my son is the one they've arrested. It was Lee Harvey Oswald's mother." Mm-hmm. My first lesson to young journalists is answer the phone.
Yeah.
When the phone rings, answer the phone. Don't wait for somebody else to answer it. But that's beside the point. Another reporter and I went out, picked her up at the address she gave us, and took her to Dallas. And she, at that point, was already talking about how people would feel sorry for his wife and give her money, and they wouldn't feel sorry for her. They'd forget her, and she'd starve. And I mean, President Kennedy's body was not cold yet, and this woman was talking about how she could make some money out of it, you know? And it was so harsh that I'm writing this down, sitting in the back seat of this car, and I'm saying, you know, this woman is under great stress. My God, how she must feel. And I sort of edited myself. Mm. I didn't put a lot of those quotes in the story. And I think had I reported what she said, I think we'd have had a better picture earlier of who he was and the influences on his life. But I just couldn't bring myself to do it at that point. It was a great lesson to me. We have to be very careful when we start censoring ourselves.
Right.
It's best to just report the story and let it let the impact fall where it may. I mean, obviously, in a wartime situation, I'm not going to report something that's going to put somebody's life in danger. I don't mean that by any stretch of the imagination. But my general rule is we're better off to just report it and let people make their own decision on what they think about it.
Bob, by raising the just reporting line, I wanted to ask you about one of the biggest changes we've seen take place in journalism, both print and TV, in the past couple of years. On television, you are seeing more and more, as many people have observed, of people tuning in to particularly cable networks that they think reaffirm their own political views, whether it's Fox or CNN or PBS or whatever. In print, in both the Times and the Post, you're seeing a move to much more analytical journalism because we're all assuming that everybody has heard most of the headlines by the time.
Which is what we assume on the evening news.
On the evening news. Yeah. They've read the internet version. This is changing the nature of what you're doing on TV, what we're doing on print, in print, what we're doing online, and occasionally what we're doing on TV.
Yeah.
For the better or for the worse?
Well, it's something we're all coming to deal with, and we don't know yet, I think, whether it's for the better or for the worse. But we know it has changed journalism more than any other single thing that's happened. At least that's my view of it. The Internet is the first vehicle that delivers news on a national and international scale that has no editor. The worst newspaper in America has at least one person there who knows where the stuff comes from that's in his newspaper. Stuff pops up on the web. You don't know where it comes from. You don't know if it's true. You don't know if it's false. There are some very good sites on the web. Your newspaper has a good one. Yours does. The Huffington Post. There are examples where people really do have certain standards. But there are other sites on the web that... they're about along the level of, say, somebody standing out on the corner holding a sign that says the end is near. They may be right, but you'd kind of like a little information about where they and how they came to that conclusion. Well, some of what we see on the web is right at that same level. We don't know where it comes from, and yet we all have to deal with it. An example, we found out on 9/11 that we spent most of our time at CBS knocking down false reports on the web. And I'm sure that you all did the same thing. Yep. In the old days, the tradition in journalism was, if I make a mistake, it's my responsibility to correct it. If my competitor does, you ignore it and wait for them to correct it. We couldn't do that on 9/11 because we ran the risk of setting off mass hysteria. I mean, we knew all the planes were on the ground, and then there'd be a report, another plane headed toward the Sears Tower. We had to go back to the same people, check again to make sure that wasn't happening. We're seeing the impact of that in this campaign. These blogs were going nuts about these things, these rumors about Sarah Palin. No part of mainstream journalism, whether it was your newspapers, our networks, none of us reported any of that. We started asking questions about it. We had an obligation to check it out. But we didn't write any of that. It was not until the McCain campaign put out the press release that said Sarah Palin's daughter was pregnant and that she was making this announcement to put down these vicious rumors that were going around. Well, of course, we then reported on that. Yet, a lot of people blame mainstream media for bringing all this up, for asking these questions. And, I mean, I think the fair thing is we should be judged on what we put in the paper and broadcast on television. We shouldn't be... questioned or blamed for the questions we ask. But again, it's this stuff that comes up on the web. We're all dealing with it. I'll just close this long answer by saying there have always been whispering campaigns in journalism and in politics. And when I was a young reporter working for the Star-Telegram in Fort Worth, about 10 days out from every election, I mean, just almost without exception, there was this report that would surface that one of the candidates had a girlfriend that lived on the east side. I don't know why it was. All girlfriends in Fort Worth used to live on the east side. In fact, I had a girlfriend that lived on the east side. But that was actually true. But and, we'd have to go and check these things out. Sometimes it got in the paper. 90% of the time, it didn't. There are no whispers now. The stuff shows up on a blog. It's out there, and it goes from here to Moscow and back before you have a time to check it out. We're all trying to figure out how to deal with it. We're all dealing with it, both the candidates and the media. But the one thing for sure, it is just different than it used to be, and it has really changed what we do.
Now, you're one of the most respected figures in American journalism. Why did you risk that reputation by becoming a country and western musician? And did the band vote to make you the lead singer?
This thing is going to do me in, yeah. I tell you, a couple of years ago, Al Hunt and Judy Woodruff asked me to be the roastie at one of the benefits that they do for spinal bifida. And I said, of course I would. And as part of the gag, I wrote this song about a guy who worked in a gas station out on I-95, worked at a Stuckey store, pumping gas. And a TV consultant came along and saw him and thought he had a nice face and just decided to make him a TV anchor man. So I wrote this song, and I mean, the chorus goes, I'm going to be a TV anchor man. I'm going to be on the eyewitness team with razor cut hair and lapels up to there. It's a new American dream. No more getting up with the chickens, no more windshields I'll have to wipe. I'll sleep till noon and by the light of the moon give my views on the scene tonight. Well, that it was a joke, right?
Right.
People liked it at that benefit. We started getting asked to come and do it at other places. We have now performed at the Waldorf in New York. But here, I'm going to give you a little news here. The day before yesterday, I got a call from the Grand Ole Opry. They're going to put on a special show on the Sunday night before the presidential debate. The one that's going to be in Nashville that'll mm-hmm. be moderated by Tom Brokaw, and Brokaw will hate me for the rest of his life. They invited me to come to the Grand Ole Opry and sing with Trisha Yearwood and Brad Paisley and all
wow.
these great country music stars, and I tell you, I'm going to do it.
Good.
I may not fool with this journalism, man. We'll see what happens, but it's going to be fun, and we're really, really, really excited about it. But I don't want anybody to think that I'm going to give up my day job quite yet, but we're having a lot of fun with it.
You know, in one of my favorite columns that you have in here, or commentaries you have in here, and I think it was one of yours, you wrote about poor people who live in trailer parks.
Mm-hmm.
You may remember that before 9/11, before Afghanistan, before Iraq, American political journalism centered on the question of people who live in trailer parks. And what you wrote in this, after hearing all of the lines that came out of the Clinton era, you know, you'll never know what you find.
You drag a $100 bill through a trailer park.
That's you know? Right.
It was a reference to Paula Jones.
That's right. And you said, A, she didn't live in a trailer park. It's true. And secondly, people don't live in trailer parks because they want to. They live there because they can't afford to live anyplace else. It was an interesting sort of effort by you to do a bit of a reality check on political dialogue. And that's a very interesting role for somebody who is also out there is a both news gatherer and extractor of news in interviews. Tell us how these commentaries fit in with.
Well, I'll tell you how that one fit in. It just occurred to me that poor people are the last group in America that has no public relations voice, no one to speak for them, to represent them, and somehow. When I heard people talking about that, I didn't have any truck with Paula Jones at all. I didn't like her or what she stood for. But the idea that you just get a free pass to make fun of poor people. My mother was poor. And I thought about her. And I just didn't like that. And I ended that essay by saying, I've known some nice people who live in trailer parks, and I've known some real trash that lived in big houses. And I tell you, there were a lot of folks out there that seemed to agree with me because we got a lot of reaction to that.
Tell us a little more about your mother. You write about her here, and at various moments in various commentaries, I've heard you mention one time you were sent off, I think maybe to do a deep investigative report on an animal park or something.
Well, when I first, my mother was a driving force in my life, and she was a very strong woman. It's sometimes really kind of difficult for me to talk about it. She was widowed at the age of 45. She had three kids. She had no other objective in life other than to see that we got what she couldn't have, and that was a college education. And I think about her every day of my life, and she was something. I'll tell you, when she died, they called me at the Star Telegram, and they said, you know, you and your brother have been quite successful. Your sister was quite successful. How did you do that? And I said, we were afraid not to be. She was right back there with a stick. and she was... She's responsible for most of of whatever I became, and I think about it all the time.
You, in many of your commentaries, you talk about the same subject over and over again over a period of time, and your views evolve, not surprisingly, as you get more information. Mm-hmm. What do you think you changed your mind most about over the years?
Well, probably the invasion of Iraq. Mm-hmm. I thought we had no choice when it happened. I mean, here is a man who we were told had weapons of mass destruction. If ever there was a human being that seemed to me would be one who would use them, it seemed to me it would be Saddam Hussein, a man who had gassed his own people, a man who killed both of his daughter's husbands after luring them back to mm-hmm. Iraq. And I thought, if that's true, if he does have these weapons, he's going to use them. And I thought at that time we had no choice. As we all came to understand, that was all based on a false premise. He didn't have weapons of mass destruction. I was very much in favor of that at the time, but I came to believe that probably that was the wrong thing for us to do. But, you know, having said that, once we got there, I thought, and I still believe, the way we leave is still very important. Mm-hmm. I think we can't just, turn around and leave. I mean, I think that would be, that really would threaten our national security, because it would be a signal that we've sort of given up. But I don't think there are any good answers there, Lynn, anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think we just have to be careful how we do it. But I think it's pretty clear that, you know, we can't stay. We can't stay there forever. You know, we asked all through Vietnam, we asked, are we winning? If you're winning, you know. It's obvious. That was the wrong question to ask. What we should have asked is it worth the price that we're paying? And we've paid a very heavy price in Iraq. It may well be that in years to come, there may well be a stable democracy there. I hope that that's the case. But we're a long way from that, although I think everyone would concede that the violence, the situation there is really down, and things are a lot better than they were. But we're a long way from being where we really ought to be, because until these factions come together, it seems to me, whatever we've done on the ground militarily is going to work for nothing. They have got to make the compromises, and it's got to be done by the Iraqis themselves. These are things that we cannot do for them. One of the things that I've come to believe is that democracy cannot be imposed from without. It has to come from within. We can help people, we can encourage people, but in the end, they've got to do it for themselves.
That answer is so typical of the very careful way that you view things and the kind of complexities of your analysis, as opposed to taking really strong views on things. Do you do that because you think it would be wrong for somebody in your position to have strong views that you would express in these commentaries, or does it come naturally to you to see the complexities of
well,
things?
Well, I do have strong views on things. I mean, I have very strong views, but I think this is just an extremely complicated situation, and I don't think you can just flip answers mm-hmm. or the answer here. I mean, I think that the thing that we in America have to remember, and I talk about in the end of the book, is our real strength comes from our values and our way of life. I mean, we put together the greatest arsenal in the history of the world during the Cold War, and those weapons kept the Soviet Union at bay. But what won the Cold War was when the people on one side of the Iron Curtain looked across and saw that the people on the other side just had a better life. They didn't want more guns and rockets. They wanted washing machines and televisions, and they wanted schools where their kids could get a good education, and they understood that they weren't getting it. And they wanted what was over there, and that's what caused the walls to come down. And I think we have to remember that. You know, Hubert Humphrey said that the 1964 Civil Rights Act was the single most effective foreign policy initiative of the last part of the 20th century. It didn't have anything to do with foreign policy, but it told the rest of the world who we are and what we stood for. That's the message that I think we have to tell the rest of the world. And the other part of it is we have to practice what we preach. We cannot say that democratic institutions are the way to go and then undermine democratic institutions. We can't be going around bribing the press and tell people that a free press is essential to democracy. We don't need to do those things. What we need to do is be telling people that's what the other guys do. And it seems to me that's the message that we have to tell not only to the rest of the world, but to our children.
Mm-hmm. Bob, just following up on your points on Iraq, it's had many costs to us, obviously. It's mm-hmm. had huge costs in lives. It's had a huge bill we've run up. But like Vietnam, it's also had a huge opportunity cost. When you get so much of the U.S. government going down the line of handling one crisis, you're giving up something else. As you were doing your interviews with senior American officials throughout this past 5 years, what have you been struck by most in terms of the opportunity costs? Was there anything that you felt we were not doing because we were so wrapped up in the run?
You know, the thing that I found most disappointing, and I think that really did cost us, is we have, and I think everybody in this room that keeps up with these kinds of things would agree, we have the most powerful military and the best military in the world. But one of the things I found most disappointing in the buildup toward Iraq is that some people really didn't want the help of other countries. They felt that we were so strong and so powerful that we could do this alone. And I think
that we could even do it better alone.
And we could do it better alone because they thought that if we brought in other countries to help in this, that it would slow American forces down. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it may have. But my observation over the years is that America is at its best when it does work with others. And it's when we try to go it alone that we have the hardest time. Because, you know, if you tell people you don't need their help and you tell them there's nothing in it for you, number one, you're not going to get any help. And number two, when it goes in the ditch, they're going to be right there to tell you what you did wrong. And I think that's what kind of happened here. I think America needs to reestablish the strongest possible relations that we can have with our traditional allies and work through the traditional international organizations. If you look back, look at what we did after World War II, and we did it with others. We can do wondrous things when we work with those who share our values. It's when we sort of think we don't really need everybody else's help. It seems to me that's when we get in the most trouble.
It looks like the presidential debates are going to be particularly important for voters in this campaign. And you're going to be moderating the last one.
Yeah.
How do you prepare for that?
Well, you know, I kind of do it the old-fashioned way. My assistant, Kaylee Hartung, she's of this new generation. She does everything electronically. Mm-hmm. I mean, she can make these computers stand on their ear, as it were. And what I've understood and come to understand is these kids that grow up with computers, it's like they spoke a second language as a child. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm learning a second language as an adult when I'm working with a computer, and I use a computer a lot, but I'm still the old, you know, get out the scissors, and mm-hmm. I clip the newspapers, and I still call David Sanger and ask him what he thinks I ought to be talking about. I talk to my friends throughout the journalism community. I talk to the folks over at CSIS mm-hmm. who've been very helpful to me. There are a lot of smart people in Washington, and I think this is a good place to do your research, but my heavens, I mean, you know, the questions that we might draw up today for these debates, by the time we get to October, we may be talking about something entirely right. different. I don't think we are. I think we're going to be focused on the economy. You know, we all talked about, and I agreed, when Sarah Palin came in, John McCain wanted a game changer, and he got one, but I think what happened yesterday on Wall Street may be another game changer here. And I think they're going to have to focus on that. Mine is going to be on domestic policy, and it's going to be all about this economy and what we do about it. Let me just tell you, we're going to have a very different format this year for the debates. The debate commission got both campaigns to agree to allow them to ask follow-up questions of each other. In the past, they've been kind of joint news conferences, as Dan Rather used to call them. He refused to call them debates. But here's what we're going to do. We're going to divide the hour and a half into nine-minute segments. It'll be my job to decide what we'll discuss in each of those segments. I will pose a question to both of them, get their answer, and then encourage them to ask the other direct questions. I mean, these will be, if it works, debates in the classic sense. And I think it might be really, really, not only really fun, but I think it would actually be enlightening. I mean, we will get to see John McCain ask Barack Obama directly about something. We will see just the opposite. And I don't know how either of them are going to be in that format. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun to find out. If they run off track, it'll be my job to kind of get them back on track. But if it works the way we hope it will, I'll pose that question, and you might not hear me from me in that segment until I say, gentlemen, thank you. It's time to move on to the next topic. And I just think, I just can't wait. I mean, this is what being a reporter is all about. Yeah. I think both of you would agree with that.
Okay, so I need to ask you about these cell phones. Mm-hmm. Okay, you read the back of this thing. There's one column after another about cell phones. There's a wonderful line here where you said that you were convinced that when Judgment Day comes, half the people lined up at the pearly gates will actually be talking on their cell phones. You have some wonderful examples when you did a commentary on things you've overheard people say on a cell phone, and then you got a fair bit of email from people who had overheard even more wild things.
Cell phones have totally changed our lives, and they have changed the culture we live in. You know, when I tell young reporters that when I was a young reporter, if you couldn't find a phone, you didn't have a story. They don't know what I'm talking about. Everybody carries their phone with them. When I really began to notice it some years ago, I walked into a restaurant in New York. There were six people sitting at a table, three of them were talking on cell phones. And I began to wonder, are they talking to each other? Would you pass the salt? How's the swordfish? You know, I mean, it's just overtaken our lives. And, you know, what really worries me is that one day somebody's going to decide that cell phones are not good for you. You know, they're not good for you, and you can't use them indoors. You'll have to go outside. If that happens, they'll have to go out to the sidewalks. Well, you can't move on the sidewalks because there are young women out there smoking, you know, which means you'll have to walk. You'll walk out in the street, and you run the risk of being run over by somebody talking on a cell phone. So. We'll see.
But as a reporting tool,
fabulous. Yeah. Oh, they're absolutely great. I mean, you know, to just be able to be in constant contact, you know, but it's amazing. We don't really, until we stop and think about it, we don't understand how much they have changed modern life, like email. I mean, think about email. You know, you now have college professors that can't get their work done because their students are all emailing them, you know. I wrote one about that. It's changed the way we respond to things. I mean, you know, the mail that I get now is much harsher than in the old days when people used to sit down and write a letter, because about half the time, if the people who are writing to me are like me, a lot of times I write these letters to the editor that in the end, once I get it out of my system, I wad it up, put it in the wastebasket, you know, go on something else. That doesn't happen with email. They press the old send button and you get it unvarnished. Yeah.
So are you a BlackBerry person?
Yeah, I do. I do use my BlackBerry, and frankly, I've gotten to the point where I couldn't get along without it. But it makes you wonder, doesn't it? How did Benjamin Franklin and those people that were negotiating an end to our war, our revolution, how did they were out of contact with the home office for 6 weeks.
That's right.
Somehow they managed to get it done.
You know, my favorite BlackBerry moment in Washington was a White House briefing early in the Iraq War when, from the podium, this press spokesman said something about our operations in Iraq that I was persuaded, as I was sitting there, was absolutely wrong. But I couldn't prove it sitting there. and I BlackBerried one of our correspondents in Iraq, who, as it turned out, was out on the street in Baghdad where BlackBerries work. And he sent me a message back saying, he's full of it, ask him about X that happened yesterday. And the press conference was still going on, and I was able to ask. And I thought to myself, this is the first time I've seen a reporting tool that really does change the nature of what we do every day.
There, I will tell you, my favorite, and you're absolutely right, it really does. My favorite story that a viewer sent to me, and he took it for the truth, he was in a restroom, and he heard the person in the next stall say, "How are you?" And he nervously answered, "Well, all right." And the person then said, "Are you free tonight?" Now, mind you, this was pre-Larry Craig. And he said, no, I'm not, actually. And then he hears the voice in the other thing say, "I'm just going to have to call you back. Every time I try to talk to you, the guy in the next stall..." But, I mean, how do people explain that? You know, yes, I'm at Niagara Falls, honey. That's that sound that you hear in the background. I just don't get it. But, I mean, we get into these situations. I was in the Admiral's Club in the airport at Denver last summer when a woman was sitting no further from me than you are, Lynn, who was outlining the whole strategy she had, this business plan that she was outlining, and they were trying to sell something, including the backup position. And I thought, if I knew who it was she was talking, right, I could actually call, and she would have gone into this business meeting that she was going to, and we would have known everything that she planned to
it's
say.
Amazing.
People get into this world where they're in just this some other land. It seems to me, you know, it's like in Harry Potter when they just walk through that invisible thing. They don't know, and they don't hear other people. They don't know what's going on. It's just amazing the impact that these things have had on our culture and our society.
Well, the people at CSIS have decided that we're having way too much fun asking you these questions, and they actually want to ruin it all by opening this up to everybody here in
okay.
the audience. I oppose this idea on, you know, all kinds of grounds, but
all right,
since I've been given no choice,
mm-hmm, okay,
we would happily take questions, and I guess there are people around with microphones right back here.
Another question. When someone is interviewing someone like Sarah Palin, I wonder if it can be difficult because she is a female. Like in the Charlie Gibson interview with Palin, it clearly showed that she didn't know what the Bush doctor was.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it would be different if Gibson was interviewing Biden? Would he ask her, "What do you know what the Bush doctrine is?"
Well, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I frankly thought Charlie did a very good job on that. I thought he was respectful. I thought he treated her with dignity, which I think he certainly should have. Anybody that's been chosen to be on a national ticket like that deserves respect. But I also thought that he, when she avoided questions, he did bore in, and he tried to ask good follow-up questions. I thought she... made a very good presentation, frankly. I think the question about the Bush Doctrine, I'm not sure I would have understood exactly what he was saying when he asked that question, so I thought she answered it all right. It became clear she knew what he was talking about. She just didn't know the formal title of that question. But I think in any interview, you just stick to the issues and you ask the questions directly. And if people don't answer or if they try to avoid the question, after you've gone at it two or three times, I think their non-answer becomes an answer. People are not stupid. They know when people are avoiding the question. And so, I mean, I think, you know, yes, she is a woman, but I think she needs to be treated with respect. But I think you have to ask her the same questions that you would ask Joe Biden.
And I also want you to know, I'm from Fort Worth, also know.
Are you really?
From Dallas.
That what? Well, we call it the Fort Worth, Dallas area. And my project these days is to get that airport changed from DFW to FWD. We're working on that. Thank you very much. Another question? Yes, go ahead.
Mr. Schieffer, what is your fondest memory of Hubert H. Humphrey of Minnesota, who you mentioned the his comments on the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act as one of the greatest contributions to American foreign policy, uh-huh. And as a quick follow-up, your remembrances on Jim Wright, former Speaker of the House.
Well, I like Jim Wright very much, and, you know, sometimes people say, does there ever a story come along where you don't think that you could do a good job on it. And when Jim Wright was investigated, when the controversy arose about him, I'd known Jim Wright since I was a kid. And I finally went to CBS and said, you know, I can't do what a reporter ought to be doing about this story. And I just asked to be taken off the story. And I was. I think Jim Wright was maybe the best congressman that Fort Worth ever had. If there was ever a congressman that represented its district better than Jim Wright did, I don't know who it was. And I've known a lot of members of Congress over the years. I thought he was a good man. And what was your other question? Oh, about Hubert Humphrey. I actually covered Hubert Humphrey's funeral, and it was a wonderful tribute. He was truly a great American, and you know, his sunny disposition, his love of politics. He was out front on civil rights. I think he'll always be remembered as one of the great, great members of the Senate. I really do. Anybody else? Yes, go ahead.
I was wondering from the three of you two, just to address journalism students and aspiring journalists out there, if you had any recommendations. If you're just about to enter the professional field,
yeah,
today.
Get a job. This is going to sound funny when I say it. Get a job as quickly as you can. If you can get one while you're mm-hmm. still in college, it'll give you a little head start. My brother, who's a lawyer, used to say you go to law school and they teach you to think like a lawyer. You have to go to work in a law firm to learn how to be a lawyer. And I think it's very much the same way with journalism. You get the theory, you get some practice while you're in school, but you really have to get out on the job and basically apprentice yourself to somebody who knows more about it than you do, and that's usually the editor you work for, and then that's how you learn to be a reporter. The first thing, if you're going to be a reporter, think about, do you like politics? Do you like people? Do you like the unusual? Do you have curiosity? I think the one thing that most great reporters I have known have is curiosity about things. Walter Cronkite's the best example. Walter wanted to know everything about everything. And, I mean, if we heard a noise outside and there was a car wreck outside, Walter Cronkite would want to run out there like it'd be he'd never seen a car wreck before. He'd want to know all about it. I remember one time we were in London and we were coming back. We'd done our stories. We had to feed them at the satellite point. We were coming back. And we heard this siren, and Walter actually said to the driver, you know, that might be the Irish Republican Army up there. Follow that car. I mean, he really said that, you know. And when we got up to where the police car stopped, guess who got to go out and check it out, see what was happening? Me. But that was just Walter. Every story, it was like his first time he'd ever seen something like that. And he had just this great love and great curiosity for knowing the inside story. And if you're that way, if you have that kind of personality, then you should be a reporter. You'll never find anything that you can do that will be more fun and more satisfying. You know, so many young people now are you know, they have this pressure to be successful. My advice is find something you really like to do. And if you get good at it, the success part will take care of itself. I know a lot of people that have a lot of money that aren't all that happy. But I know people who do something that they love to do and follow, really, it's corny to say it, follow their dreams. They're the ones that seem to have the best lives, as far as I'm concerned. So if this is something that you really like to do, then this is what you ought to do. But if it's not, and, you know, there are a lot of other meaningful things that where you can make a real contribution. But just find the thing that really seems like fun to you, and then it'll never seem like you have a job. Uh-huh. Is there one back here? Yeah.
Bob, of listening to you, that you're talking about starting out with a phone, and I'm thinking that we both will have worked with film where you only had so many feet in a can before
yeah.
it got processed. And then you remember the fax and how exciting the fax was in the 80s. You now do a broadcast that literally can draw a picture, a correspondent in from any part of the world. But I wonder, when you think about the 40-year game that you've seen, whether our world has gotten bigger or smaller. And in terms of what the viewer actually sees, whether that global village that I think we grew up with in the 60s mm-hmm. and 70s, dreaming that we'd be able to bring, whether you think that we're doing it?
Well, I think what I think is that we are seeing more, and our technological abilities are wondrous. I mean, you know, we can talk to people on the other side of the world. David talks about emailing somebody in Baghdad, you know, while a news conference is going on. I still believe that you need reporters on the scene to get the story straight. And I think journalism will still rise or fall on the courage and the professionalism and the desire of the individual reporter who's willing to go where the news is, try to sort it out to the best of his ability, and report it. There are a lot of things you can do with technology. You know, there are a lot of, it's easier to get the pictures around. But getting the understanding of what's actually happening on the ground, I still think there's no better way to do it than to have a reporter on the scene to do that.
So can you tell us a little bit about how your side of the industry and our side of the industry is doing now that we have fewer reporters on the scene, particularly overseas, as an industry, than I think probably at any time since you went into the business?
I think that's probably right. I mean, these costs are just enormous, and the pressures on newspapers are greater than they are even on broadcasters now. We're having to find different ways to do these things. We're having to find ways to find the revenue to finance these very expensive enterprises. Bill Keller of the New York Times tells me he spends $2 million a year, something like that, just on security. To keep his
yep.
Baghdad bureau
yep.
open.
That's right. Yep.
I expect you
very expensive.
About the same at the
yep.
Washington Post. Certainly we are.
And these, you know, bureaus look like the castle of a meddling drug lord. I mean, they are...
Well, exactly. Very, yeah. And when we talk about these citizen journalists and these bloggers and stuff, no blogger has $2 million to spend on right. security. It takes a pretty powerful and a big news organization to pay these kinds of costs in order to report the news. But that's our role, and we have to find a way to do it. Yes, sir.
This campaign has laid bare some pretty strong polar opposites,
mm-hmm.
politically speaking. We've got liberals, we've got conservatives, Democrats, Republicans. My question is, over time, and based on your perspective, do you see the country... are we polarizing more today than we have been in decades past? Or are we more of a moderate middle than in decades past?
I think we're pretty polarized right now, to be quite honest about it. And I think one reason for that is because, as David mentioned in the beginning, we can now get the news served up from any point of view that we're comfortable with. If you want it from a conservative point of view, you can find that. If you want it from a very liberal point of view, you can find that. The result is we're not all getting the same stuff anymore. The common experience that we once had when most people depended on television or the big newspapers is just not there anymore. And I think that's one of the reasons for that. But I think what we all have to do, and it's a new burden on the consumer, we just got to get our news from more than one source if we're going to feel that we are truly informed these days. I mean... You know, citizenship does require a little work, and I think for the country to be informed, you have to work as a consumer of news, just as we have to work as those who report the news. But I don't think there's any question about it. I think things are more polarized than they have been for many reasons that go beyond just what I've told you, but I think it is. We are going to have to cut this off because Andrew?
I can't resist, Bob. I have to ask all three of you quickly. Who is the most challenging interview you ever did and why?
David.
Probably Ahmadinejad, I would think. I've never had an interview subject before who answered every question with five questions of his own.
Margaret Thatcher, because she argued with every question you asked before she would answer it.
And I would have to say the most frustrating for me, and she was a very nice woman, and I think she was a very effective attorney general. But in my case, it was Janet Reno, who prefaced every single question with a phrase, as I have said many times before. And I'm telling you, every time she said that, you could hear refrigerator doors opening and toilets flushing all over America. People would say, well, no news here. I can run take a quick break. And she never realized she did it. I thought she was a lovely person. But sometimes I just wish I could have gotten her aside and say, if you would just not say that before you answer the question. Thank you all very much. You're so sweet in the comments. Really appreciate it. Thank you, man. Thank you, David. Oh, shit. Sure.